I next met with Dr. Kathy Albane, and to begin, as a follow-up to the discussion about the new cooperative group effort looking at adjuvant everolimus in higher-risk ER-positive HER2-negative disease, Dr. Albane reviewed the current algorithm for triage of patients to either that trial or the so-called RxPONDER study evaluating the role of the 21-gene recurrence score in patients with node-positive disease. Dr. Albane first commented on the everolimus study.
So it's for any patient with four or more positive nodes. Then if 0 to 3, those patients with recurrence scores less than or equal to 25 go on the other trials, the responder trial, which is the so-called 1007 trial for node-positive disease, or the Taylor X trial. So that's the 1 to 3s are randomized to chemo versus chemoendocrine therapy for recurrent scores under 25. So there's this group that have up to 3 positive nodes from 0 to up to 3 who have high recurrent scores, high-risk patients. So those can also be randomized on the new trial.
Right, but what I found fascinating is the integration of recurrence score into an algorithm for trial eligibility that includes node-positive patients, because I am not sure I've seen that before. I guess, obviously, the RxPONDER does, but you know, beyond that, I just think it's interesting commentary in terms of how the trial was designed. But you know, I think the thing that I was really curious about is, I'm trying to remember how many years ago it was that you presented for the first time in San Antonio data on a genomic predictor in node-positive breast cancer, in this case, Oncotype, coming out of your classic SWOG trial. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, looking back at this point, where we're at right now with this issue of, I guess, biology versus anatomy.
Right. Well, I think that's where we have to be. I think the days are over when we allow all types of biologies into the same type of trial. So I don't think there's any difference between a node 0 to 3 high recurrent score patient than a 4 or more node high recurrent score tumor in a patient. The problem we get into, of course, is the more nodes that are positive, the risk of recurrence goes up, of course. And if you have a recurrence score of 2 in that patient with many positive nodes, are you going to feel comfortable giving endocrine therapy alone? So that's why the responder trial originally was proposed with all types of nodal status, not just 1 to 3. But, you know, you have that patient in front of you in your office, you're very nervous of taking a 6 positive node patient and not giving chemotherapy just because they're high risk, but the biology is telling you it's probably not going to be chemosensitive no matter how many nodes are positive. So we go round and round in this circle right now. And should we even consider, for example, amending the responder trial now that it's accruing so well and add in more positive nodes? And those discussions have been underway all along, and we'll see what happens there. But I agree that there's angst, and I agree that the biology is telling us something here. And what we need to do, perhaps there, for example, is give endocrine therapy plus everolimus and no chemotherapy. I mean, there's a patient population where you really do need to address targeting another pathway that's driving, you know, whether it's mTOR with everolimus or others. That's the direction our trials are going to go. That's for sure. I don't have a doubt.
I have to ask you about this poster that you did at San Antonio that has a really interesting title, and I tried to understand what it actually said, but I'm really looking forward to hearing you explain it to me, which is a study that looked at metabolic syndrome and recurrence score. I thought that was really cool. What did you look at?
Okay, so this was done by one of my colleagues at Loyola and one of our fellows, just looking at our experience with patients we had sent the recurrence score on, and then doing a chart review and determining the components of the metabolic syndrome or not, obesity, diabetes, all of those various aspects of it. And basically what we found was that the recurrence scores that are very low, a large percentage of those patients may be the so-called luminal A type, and they still have recurrence risk, but it appears to be, you know, having the metabolic syndrome or not is a major independent predictor of risk in that group. So in that particular biology, doing more aggressive interventions may be leading to a survival advantage. So we need to validate this in a larger trial sample. And once we do, we might be able to propose a new approach. Of course, you always talk to every patient about losing weight, getting their diabetes under control, exercising, etc. But a more intensive, prospectively designed approach for that population may be in order. So this was just a hypothesis-generating, small retrospective study, but still intriguing, which is why it got on the program in the poster discussion session.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the clinical scenarios that you brought in here in terms of, you know, common problems that people face and, you know, maybe some of the specific points you want to get into about it. Maybe we can start out with the situation of the 55-year-old postmenopausal patient.
So we have a 55-year-old postmenopausal patient with T1C, N1, M0, strongly ER positive, Allred score 8, HER2 negative grade 1, low key 67. She was treated with a lumpectomy, and there's a plan for standard radiotherapy. 2 of 5 sentinel lymph nodes and 0 of 1 non-sentinel lymph nodes were positive, so a total of 2 out of 6 nodes positive.
So, you know, a very practical question would be, how do you think you would manage this situation outside her protocol, and are there any studies that you think you might want to be thinking about for a patient like this?
You know, the other scenario that maybe what we could think of is the other scenario that's just as common is the same age, postmenopausal status, tumor characteristics, except the tumor is only mildly estrogen receptor positive, say an Allred score of 4, it's high grade 3, and has a key 67 that's borderline. So you have situations here where in both cases, I find the 21 gene recurrence score is very helpful to me in practice. And I do not fully accept that the immunohistochemical shorthand determination of luminal status is there yet for predicting chemotherapy benefit. And in fact, call your audience's attention to be on the lookout for the St. Gallen paper that is coming out very shortly based on the deliberations of the consensus panel held in early March of 2013. So this issue was hotly debated and discussed at length. And well, let's just say for HER2 negative disease, can you take the shorthand determination of ER, PR, and key 67, which is what St. Gallen Group published in 2011, as your luminal subtyping?
How about grade?
Well, grade is even more problematic. So let's just focus for now on those characteristics. The problem is key 67 is not yet arrived in terms of reproducibility, not only across laboratories, but among expert pathologists that do this. So the concern is that you may be over or under treating some patients if you just use that to select your therapy. So that's why I would send a 21 gene recurrence score, because I believe that has the best predictive validation of all the assays right now, and see what the score is to help me ascertain whether this woman with 2 positive nodes, regardless of what the IHC is saying, has a biology that may be able to avoid chemotherapy. Now, ideally, I enroll her on, you asked me to talk, outside of a trial, but SWOG 1007, the responder trial, is open nationally, and most sites can access this trial now. So here's an ideal patient for that trial.
So the idea would be you send the recurrence score, and if it's low, they go in that study, chemo versus not. If it's high, there's the possibility of going on the Everolimus study.
Correct. Off protocol, then I take that score, which is, as you know, a continuous variable, and I show the patients the plot from the SWOG 8814 publication in Lancet Oncology, with all the caveats that it's a smaller study, that it's being validated, but if not going on the trial, this is where your tumor's recurrence score sits in terms of the potential chemotherapy benefit, and talk about that issue. So I feel very comfortable in the 2+ node setting doing that.
So I actually have been to the St. Gallen meeting a couple times now. It's like just too much travel, you know, this little train out and all that stuff. But it is a great meeting. But and also my memory of it was kind of very strong, as you would imagine, European flair. So I'm really curious to know what they concluded about this whole issue of genomic profiling, which test, and in what situation, particularly node positive?
So which test, and that's another whole issue, the combination of MammaPrint with BluePrint can give you the intrinsic subtype, although again, it's not been validated in a prospective phase 3 trial like the recurrence score.
What's BluePrint?
Okay, so BluePrint gives you luminal, basal, and HER2. It gives you a 3-type categorization. In the luminals, by applying MammaPrint and finding whether their luminals are high or low risk, then you come up with luminal A and luminal B, is how that's being done. So that's relatively new. There's a study called NBRST that reported at a poster at St. Gallen the first results. And what they showed was that of 89 patients who had the IHC shorthand for luminal, I believe it was 19 of those were recategorized into basal or HER2 positive. So, and then there's PAM50. PAM50 is the paraffin block application of intrinsic subtyping. PAM50 has shown in the neoadjuvant setting for low risk of recurrence score from PAM50, no pathologic CRs. So all of these genomic profiles are showing that they're prognostic. We're now struggling with, are all of them equally predictive of chemotherapy benefit or not? But I think the bottom line is you'll see coming out in the new St. Gallen consensus, much higher acceptance of using these profiles to help select therapy. I think there is a growing sentiment, having been to 5 St. Gallens in a row now, to accepting the reality of these assays and how they can help us in practice. And in particular, I don't think anyone is ready to state we should be doing this in many positive nodes. But in the few positive node scenario, it is considered reasonable to use them outside of a trial. And in the same sentence, please accrue to the trial because the trial will answer the question.
So just taking a global step back, you know, over the last 10 years since the Oncotype first came out and then all these other assays, you know, one of the things that's been done is to go to trials that were randomized that were already completed and go back, as was done with your node positive trials. Do you think that that's kind of the wave for the future, or do you think it's going to be more prospective trials or both?
Well, we can't go back because there's no back to go to. The problem is NSABP B20 and SWOG 8814 are really the only two trials with the tamoxifen alone control that banked specimens. So these newer trials now, TAILORx and Responder, have a very rich tumor bank that's going to allow us to look at all of the new generation predictors because we're going to be beyond 21 gene and 70 gene not too far in the future. And at least with SWOG 8814, we are proposing a next generation seq approach on our residual RNA. We still have enough to ask some more questions, so we want to be very careful in how we expend the rest of this resource because there's enough there to ask a few more questions, so we'll be doing that.
Interesting. So I want to just finish out with your neoadjuvant HER2 positive case scenario, a 46-year-old premenopausal patient that you describe with a 2.5 centimeter palpable infiltrating ductal cancer, HER2 2 plus, but FISH positive, ER negative, high key 67 and grade 3. Maybe you can talk about how you think through this kind of scenario.
So let's talk outside of a trial scenario. In most cases, unless she has an extremely generous breast size, this particular patient would do very well with a neoadjuvant approach. Certainly could have surgery up front as well. So there are, how do you approach neoadjuvant HER2-based therapy? How do you approach adjuvant HER2-based therapy is the reason I selected this case. But should you approach it with a neoadjuvant regimen? Which should it be? Is there one approach you should consider? And I think that where we're going in I-SPY 2 is where I'm going in my practice outside of I-SPY 2, which is to give the taxane plus trastuzumab portion first to make sure that there is no detriment in cardiac function from the anthracycline phase. and then bring the anthracyclines in. So I am still not embracing giving non-anthracycline-based therapy to everyone with HER2-positive disease. So I would not immediately select TCH, for example, up front in the neoadjuvant setting or in the adjuvant setting, preferring a taxane and anthracycline-based approach.
But you're saying this is all neoadjuvant?
Yes.
And
oh, you can treat the patient postoperatively in standard adjuvant
setting,
and there we have similar options.
Any new post-neoadjuvant research issues you might want to comment on?
There are a number of strategies and trial design for patients with residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy. In seeing second and third opinions a lot, I get this question asked me frequently. It's a great question from community oncologists of whether your patient with residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy should get additional treatment. A lot of these women, for example, will have endocrine responsive disease. So don't forget, you are, and I just reassured a patient last week, we're going on of my own who had residual disease after HER2-based therapy, exactly this patient scenario. And I told her, look, we're going to start you on an aromatase inhibitor and continue your trastuzumab, and you're going to be on treatment. So that's also treating the patient. And then you throw in the role of the bisphosphonates in postmenopausal patients. And should we be moving toward doing more of that? And that's a story, obviously, that's a separate Neil Love audio.
Well, I'm hoping it's going to be a Neil Love audio for San Antonio, because I just interviewed Richard Pito and I didn't realize he's doing a meta-analysis on the whole bisphosphonate thing.
Correct.
So that should be very, very cool. Well, you mentioned endocrine therapy, though, in this patient situation with a HER2-positive tumor. Just in general, whether it's neoadjuvant or adjuvant, do you sort of think through endocrine therapy differently if the tumor is HER2-positive?
Well, when you look at the big adjuvant trials, trastuzumab was effective across ER status, of course. But I think where we don't know quite what to do is, does the level of estrogen receptor expression or the so-called luminal status of that patient's HER2-positive disease impact what you do in the endocrine setting? And there, we don't have time to delve into all of that, but there is probably a difference. And I think we all treat these patients similarly. We, for example, we all give tamoxifen or an AI to a node-positive patient with a recurrent score that's very high. But there's data from the NSABP that they publish that we just don't use clinically because our default is to give that hormonal therapy, but it's probably not doing anything in that biology. So again, all of this needs to be sorted out a bit better because we are probably over-treating with endocrine therapy in some scenarios too.
And that actually leads into another question I had relating to the low recurrence score situation, because again, it's not just about, you know, relative lack of response to chemo, but also, as you say, hormones and ERPR rich and maybe more hormone sensitive. And you know, the luminal A kind of, you know, also biology. And that kind of leads into the last thing I want to ask you about is, I have, of course, every time I talk to a breast cancer investigator nowadays, we got to talk about duration of adjuvant hormone therapy in view of the ATLAS presentation. So I'm curious right now, particularly as it relates to having seen those data, what you do in your own practice outside a trial setting and a patient who gets the 5 years who's on tamoxifen, and a patient who gets the 5 years is on an AI.
So I am discussing extending tamoxifen for 5 more years in premenopausal patients. In postmenopausal patients, you also have MA17, which is 5 years of aromatase inhibitor after 5 years of tamoxifen. You have several other trials looking at extending the aromatase inhibitor to a full 5 years after some tamoxifen. I just do believe that longer is probably better, regardless of how you do it. And if you have a patient with really strong luminal biology who's tolerating their therapy, I believe it's reasonable. Now, with tamoxifen, though, that uterine cancer risk starts to jump up. And it was in the publication in the New England Journal, but we have to really counsel our patients about that. Granted, it's a curable cancer, usually at stage one when it develops and all the other disclaimers, but we have to be careful. And if the patient does become postmenopausal, you have that AI to bring in there and may still choose it over and above 5 more years of tamoxifen if there's a uterine cancer concern.
One final question. Can you comment a little bit on the management of ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease? And while there's a lot of excitement about everolimus, another issue out there is the SWOG study looking at the question of combining fulvestrant and an AI. Any comment on that strategy?
This was a phase 3 trial conducted by the Southwest Oncology Group, number SWOG-0226, which was for first-line estrogen receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer in postmenopausal patients, so very common patient presentation that we see every week. At the time this study was designed, standard of care was either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And of course, many of these patients who present with first onset of metastatic disease are recurrent, actually, from the adjuvant setting. Although, of course, patients who are de novo diagnosed metastatic were also included. But since most of them had recurred after adjuvant therapy, many of them had seen tamoxifen. So the standard of care for these patients in all settings was to give an aromatase inhibitor. So the randomization in this trial was the aromatase inhibitor alone or the combination of aromatase inhibitor anastrozole plus fulvestrant as the experimental arm. The study showed a survival benefit, an overall survival benefit to the combination. And it should be pointed out that there was an option for patients in the single arm to go on and receive the combination at the time of progression. So that makes these findings, I think, even more significant and very, very unusual to see a survival benefit in an endocrine therapy trial. Thus, the interest in the New England Journal, I believe, in taking this paper.
I guess one of the things about the paper that I found interesting is that the dose of fulvestrant, where it was 500 initially, but then 250. And since then, I think the standards moved more towards 500. So you would expect whatever benefit. I mean, maybe actually there's more benefit if you were using the higher dose.
Yes, and the study was amended to move to the higher dose once those data came out. So the patients, as you point out, did have two different doses of fulvestrant, depending on the time they enrolled in the trial.
And I guess one of the issues about this trial, which, as you say, is pretty unusual to see one type of endocrine therapy versus another show this kind of benefit, is that there had been another trial that was very similar that didn't find the same result. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there's been a lot of friendly debate about that issue, and I think it probably boils down to, without getting too technical, into the type of prior therapy and the type of patient that was entered on each of these two trials was a bit different. I think perhaps a more burning question for practitioners is what would have happened if there was a third arm in there of fulvestrant alone. And we don't know the answer to that question, but I think kind of two camps have evolved since the study was published about whether this should be a practice-changing result or not. And having entered lots of my own patients on this trial and been involved in the trial from the start, I'm very impressed with the combination, with the tolerance of the combination. And so I do choose this regularly in my practice as a frontline approach for patients who I feel can be treated with endocrine therapy alone.
And just out of curiosity, anastrozole or letrozole that you combine, or exemestane with fulvestrant?
Yeah, so the trial had anastrozole, and I believe that at least without anything combined with them, they are relatively equivalent regimens. I think where there's differences is intolerance. And I have been struck with interpatient variability in which AI they tolerate, which aromatase inhibitor they tolerate. And I will switch in given patients from one to another. And sometimes severe bone toxicity with one AI does not translate to another AI. So I will extrapolate from data that indicate that the efficacy of the three AIs is basically similar. And if a patient's not tolerating one AI, I will combine fulvestrant with a different AI, with the caveat that was not the AI in the study.
So you mentioned that you utilize this strategy, and I'm just kind of curious in terms of in what situation. So I'm guessing, based on what you're saying, that if a patient either presents with metastatic disease or has never had endocrine therapy, that in general this is the strategy you use in a postmenopausal patient now?
Well, not everybody. If you have a patient with I mean, there's different scenarios. Someone just coming off adjuvant therapy with very aggressive luminal B-ish type metastatic disease, meaning a lot of visceral organ disease involvement, a more aggressive pace to disease, and the more indolent endocrine responsive metastatic disease, I would think twice about a hormonal approach in general for that type of patient. There are certain patients where I may choose to add everolimus to aromatase inhibitor as my first choice. But as a rule, the longer you can give the therapy with the best quality of life, I think you should do that. And since this trial showed a survival benefit, in the absence of data of what fulvestrant alone would do in this particular setting, I think that it's easy to do and relatively cost-effective given the generic availability of all the AIs right now.
Now, in that situation that you described, you know, the patient with more tumor burden, maybe they've got symptoms, do you utilize the strategy of sort of short-term chemo followed by longer-term endocrine, maybe maintenance?
Yes, that's another good approach where you achieve disease control status. I don't think there's ever been a randomized trial to ask whether just a chemotherapy holiday versus starting an endocrine therapy would lead to better outcome. That's a very good question, Neil. And I think many of us do, if they've never seen, especially endocrine therapy, find it reasonable to start an endocrine option at that point. But is that disease endocrine responsive that's left behind? We don't know, unless you biopsy and determine the molecular profiling. And I think we are going in that direction.